London, this is VOA News. Supreme Court Justice nominee Brett Kavanaugh was grilled by the Senate Judiciary Committee for a second day, but when senators asked Mr. Kavanaugh, if he'd recuse himself from any cases involving matters coming before the court that involve the special counsel's Russia investigation, the answers were nonspecific.
If I committed to deciding a particular case, which includes committing to whether I would participate in a particular case, all I would be doing is demonstrating that I don't have the independence of the judiciary of the judging that is necessary to be a good judge.
Democrats are worried Kavanaugh will be another barrier to legal accountability for President Trump. U.S. and Canadian negotiators pushed ahead in grinding talks to rescue the North American Free Trade Agreement Thursday. President Donald Trump has set a deadline for a deal this week, prompting aides to U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer and Canadian Foreign Minister Chrystia Freeland to work well into the evening Thursday to find ways to move forward.
A good deal for Canada, the U.S., and Mexico is absolutely achievable. That is what we are working towards, and that's our goal that we are unrelentingly and single-mindedly focused on.
A source familiar with the discussion said it's unclear whether the two sides could bridge the gaps or whether Trump will opt for a Mexico-only bilateral trade deal. Passengers and crew on two flights arriving in Philadelphia from Europe Thursday were screened by medical teams after 12 people aboard became ill with flu-like symptoms a day after a similar outbreak on a flight from Dubai to New York. All 250 people on separate airlines flights were held for medical review. This is VOA News. Britain has presented the UN with evidence that Russia ordered the chemical attack against a former spy last spring in Salisbury. AP correspondent Warren Levinson reports.
British Ambassador Karen Pierce told the Security Council Russian agents were behind the poisoning of a former spy and his daughter.
We have clear evidence,
which Russia's ambassador denounced as a mendacious cocktail of facts.
London needs this story for just one purpose, to unleash a disgusting anti-Russian hysteria.
Vasily Nebenzia spoke through a UN interpreter. He said Russia's attempts to help in the investigation of the case have been rebuffed. Said Pierce, you don't recruit an arsonist to put out a fire. Warren Levinson, New York.
Hundreds of people took to the streets of Iraq's southern oil city of Basra for a fourth day of violent protests on Thursday, where residents, angry over the neglect of their city's collapsing infrastructure, set fire to political offices. Eight demonstrators have been killed in clashes with security forces and dozens injured since a wave of protests began on Monday. Protesters on Thursday targeted several provincial government buildings, setting the headquarters of the local government on fire, also blocking main roads in the city center. South Korean officials say high-level talks will be held early next week among representatives from the two Koreas to prepare for a meeting of the leaders of the two countries September 18th through 20th. South Korea's national security advisor said the meetings will take place at the peace village of Panmunjom to discuss protocol, security, communications, and media coverage as part of preparations for the summit. Wednesday, a five-person South Korean delegation led by President Moon Jae-in's top security advisor visited the North Korean capital and agreed to the summit dates. Reuters correspondent Grace Lee has more.
Kim Jong-un's new groundbreaking message to Donald Trump, he's putting an end to his long-range missile tests and planning to denuclearize by early 2021. The North Korean leader claims rocket launches and nuclear tests have become permanently impossible after Pyongyang dismantled test sites earlier this year. His words were relayed by South Korean officials on Thursday after they met with Kim in Pyongyang this week. They say Kim told them that his faith in the U.S. president remains, quote, unchanged, and that he wants to denuclearize during Trump's first term. It marks the first time the North Korean leader has offered a timeline for getting rid of his weapons.
Grace Lee reporting. New York's attorney general issued civil subpoenas Thursday to all eight Roman Catholic dioceses in the state as part of a sex abuse investigation. I'm Lori London, VOA News.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Mbatha in Washington. Today is Friday, September 7th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Ugandan legislator Bobi Wine vows to return to Uganda after his medical treatment here in the United States.
We advocate for people power, which indeed is our power, and to assert that no amount of brutality, no amount of repression is going to cow us down.
That's Bobi Wine. Meanwhile, the Ugandan government has again denied that its security forces tortured Bobi Wine. There are renewed calls to invalidate the recent removal of presidential age limit in Uganda. Human rights defenders in Malawi say they are under threat. And a South Sudan military court has sentenced 10 soldiers to prison terms for raping and aid workers and murdering a local journalist in 2016.
There are so many victims of such assaults in South Sudan. This one is a special case because most of the victims were international community members. But what if they were South Sudanese?
An independent lawyer who represented some of the rape victims. And Zimbabwe authorities called on citizens to up their hygienic game following 6 suspected cholera deaths. Those stories plus Samson O'Malley's sports and our listener of the day are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Ugandan parliamentarian Robert Chagulayi, popularly known as Rob Bobi Wine, says he plans to return to Uganda as soon as his specialized medical treatment in the United States is over. He says Ugandans have always wanted to live in a country where their leaders are servants of the people. Wine and other members of parliament were jailed last month after a by-election campaign during which President Yoweri Museveni's convoy was reportedly pelted with rocks. The government accused Wine of being behind the attack. Wine was allegedly tortured, although the Ugandan government denies the allegations. During a news conference Thursday in Washington, D.C., Wine said no amount of brutality would scare him from returning to Uganda.
I'm glad to be here, and most importantly, I'm glad to still be alive. I'm here against the advice of my doctors and my family, but I thought it's more important to be here, especially on behalf of my fellow Ugandans, particularly those in Chadondo East and those that still go through the repression. It should be noted that I'm not presenting myself as a victim because I'm nobody's victim. I'm a survivor, and I would rather represent resilience rather than giving up. I was brutally tortured by the soldiers from the SFC, beaten, brutalized, and abused, and later locked up in the military barracks. Charges were later dropped, and I was taken to a civil prison. And finally, I was bailed up. I'm here for specialized treatment, which I'm still undergoing. I am humbled to see that my brutalization has attracted the attention of my countrymen and women, and indeed the world over. But still, I'm challenged because many other Ugandans go through the same or even worse brutalities. For example, when I was in prison, there's this guy that cannot go off my mind whose back was broken. There's a lady who had just had a baby through a C-section, was beaten so bad that by the time we were released, she was still passing blood. There's another lady called Sauda, who I don't know if she will survive. All these people and many others, I'm sad that the world might never know them. So the opportunity that I get, I always want to raise my voice to speak for them, because I'm lucky that maybe the world knows me but may never know such people. And I want to use every ability in my voice to speak out for them. And that's why I'm here, ladies and gentlemen. And yes, I'm also here to symbolize the resilience of Ugandans, to tell them that we still stand for justice, equality, freedom, and dignity for everybody. We represent the power of the people. Ugandans have always been wanting freedom. They've always been wanting to be the masters of their destiny. They've always wanted to live in a country where leaders are servants and the people are the true masters. And that is what we still advocate for. We advocate for people power, which indeed is our power. and to assert that no amount of brutality, no amount of repression is going to cow us down. I'm here for treatment, and as soon as my treatment is done, I am going back home, because Uganda is my home. Uganda is our home.
That was Ugandan parliamentarian Robert Chakulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine. He spoke Thursday during a news conference here in Washington, D.C. The Ugandan government says parliamentarian Robert Chakulanyi, popularly known as Bobi Wine, was not tortured by security personnel. Government spokesman Ovando Opondo says Bobi Wine is simply employing diversionary tactics and looking for public sympathy. Ovando tells Daybreak Africa reporter Mugumi Davis-Rakarinj that calls by Bobi Wine's lawyer for the United States to suspend military aid to Uganda are simply nonsensical.
Somebody tortured to the extent he claims, traveling more than 20 hours without medical assistance to the U.S. and begins addressing press conferences. I think he's simply looking for media attention, I should say. The lie he's making is a big lie. He will be disproved with time.
His lawyer, Amsterdam, says that the United States government should suspend all the military funding because according to Honorable Chagurani and his lawyer, they're saying that the military aid that is given by the U.S. Makes the Ugandan military actually to continue oppressing the opposition.
Well, I don't know the repute of Mr. Bob Amsterdam, either his illegal repute, investigative repute, or even wild diplomacy repute. I don't know whether he understands fully American global policy dynamics. But in any case, if Chagurani was tortured using ropes and sticks, where does American arms come? So Uganda really doesn't need American arms. If Uganda government is a torturer of its people, does not need American arms, does not need European arms, does not need external arms. There are enough sticks and stones and ropes here to tie people and beat them up.
So in that case, you're not denying that Honorable Chagurani was beaten or tortured?
First of all, I am saying he was not tortured. And if he claims so, there are reports here which show that he has no torture injuries, and he has no injuries or any ailment which warranted any referral which he had gone for.
What should Honorable Chagurani expect on his return?
First of all, the Uganda government never sent him out. We don't know why he's out. He went out on his free will. And when he's eventually tired of gallivanting out, he's free to return.
That was Ugandan government spokesman Ofwando Opondo. He was speaking from Kampala with reporter Mugumi Davis-Rakarinj. The lawyer for six Ugandan opposition parliamentarians has petitioned the Supreme Court to invalidate the recent removal of presidential age limit from the Constitution. Attorney Ladislaus Rakafuzi says violence and bribery were used in the campaign behind the change. Parliamentarians from the ruling National Resistance Movement, the NRM, voted overwhelmingly for the amendment to remove age restriction that would have prevented President Yoweri Museveni from seeking additional terms in office. VOA's Peter Clotte spoke to Attorney Rakafuzi about this petition.
We are appealing to the Supreme Court. We expect the Supreme Court to rule in our favor and invalidate the passage of that amendment to the Constitution so that we can have a peaceful transition from Museveni to any other person peacefully, instead of having to flex muscles like we always do to the expense of people's lives and property.
You talked about violence, other technical matters, and bribery as the bedrock of the appeal to have the constitutional amendment be invalidated. Now, some people are saying this is a figment of the opposition's because they have no proof.
It can't be a figment. It can't be the figment of the opposition. That money, the condemnation, was not explained. We don't know why that money was given. And one of the judges who sat on the panel, the five judges, said, really, this was bribery. And we think that that's what really should have been seen. Why the MPs were given this money, it's not understood why. So that one, for us, as far as we are concerned, we want the Supreme Court to find that this was bribery, and on that ground, invalidate the amendment. And then the violence, it's not a figment of the opposition's minds, because there are people who were paid by Parliament to go abroad for treatment. Some members of Parliament who are subjected to beatings and torture and those who went to the locals are there. All those documents, we showed them to court. So that violence existed both in parliament and outside. So really, it's not a statement of the opposition. Even they themselves in government, they know that. After all, even at the very beginning of this debate, the minister of finance, that time, that young lady called Anita, said we have the army. That's what she said. She said we shall pass the amendment for the elected or not because the army is on our side. We have the army. So, and they deployed it. The Kampala was a no-go zone. It was during that debate, the whole of this Kampala, they had it deployed. The whole of it, from Matete to Mboya to everywhere, it was full of the military and full of armed. So people could not move, people could not debate. So the amendment was passed through violence.
Some ruling party supporters are suggesting that your statement that you cannot amend the constitution without involving the people is neither here nor there, since the parliamentarians who voted are representing the people of Uganda, and that your move and your statement basically is an opposition-filled theatrics to undermine the rule of law as established in the constitution.
No, every major amendment to the constitution, a member of parliament dealing with such a matter, facing such a matter, must go back home and consult, is a kind of delegate. Because people, this is a pastoral democracy. People participate in the day-to-day decisions of parliament. They give their views.
Ladislaus Rakafuzi is the lawyer for 6 Ugandan opposition parliamentarians. He spoke with viewers Peter Clotte from Kampala. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Friday, September 7th. Daybreak Africa time is coming up at 17 minutes past the hour. A South Sudan military court has sentenced 10 soldiers to prison terms for raping 8 workers and murdering a local journalist in July 2016 during an attack on Terrain Hotel in Juba. Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
Issa Muzamil Sebit, an independent lawyer who represented some of the victims in the Terrain Hotel case, says he believes justice has been served. He says the verdict was based on Penal Code 2008 and Espele Act 2009 and should pave the way for ending impunity when crimes are committed in South Sudan. But Sebit says he believes many South Sudanese have suffered similar abuses and are yearning for justice. He advises the SPLA to work toward repairing its image of repeatedly committing human rights abuses, including rape and murder.
There are so many victims of such assaults in South Sudan. This one is a special case because most of the victims were international community members. But what if they were South Sudanese? Should we keep quiet because there's nobody to talk or to fight for them? So all this kind of sexual assault, whether directed against men or women, is unacceptable under the law.
South Sudanese lawyer Philip Senyang represented Terrain Hotel owner Mike Woodwood during the trial.
With this verdict, we have hope to say that there's hope within our judicial institutions.
Sebit also says today's verdict should be an eye-opener to South Sudanese security forces who commit human rights abuses across the country. Colonel Santo Domich is the deputy military spokesman.
The warning that the SPLA would like to give to its ranks and files at all the capacities is that the SPLA will not tolerate acts of rape or any other forms of sexual assault directed against women and other vulnerable people committed by its troops in Terrain Hotel or any other places. Any person who commits similar act will be dealt with accordingly with the law.
Sebit says if South Sudan's military is to ever participate in future international engagements, including peacekeeping operations, its military leaders must create a disciplined army.
You never know, one day the SPLA could be asked to send forces outside. So such behaviors of soldiers going to rape or commit other kind of crime needs to be discouraged, and the SPLA leadership must make sure that whenever allegations of rape is brought to their attention, they must act promptly.
The U.S. Embassy in Juba released a statement saying it welcomes today's verdicts but urges South Sudan's leaders to ensure they bring to justice other perpetrators of human rights abuses During the five-year conflict, the embassy went on to say the United States will, quote, continue to utilize tools including targeted sanctions to take action against those who attempt to sow chaos, work against peace, and commit serious human rights abuses in South Sudan, end of quote. For VOA News, I'm Waki Simon Wudu in Juba.
The UN Human Rights Office says human rights defenders and activists in Malawi are under increasing threat as pre-electoral politics heats up before next year's general election. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The run-up to next May's presidential, parliamentary, and council elections is becoming nastier and more dangerous for those trying to hold authorities in Malawi to account. The UN Human Rights Office reports thugs attacked the offices of the Center for Human Rights and Rehabilitation in the capital, Lilongwe, last week. Reports say the attackers viciously beat up a guard and threw a gasoline bomb at the center's offices, causing an extensive fire. Human rights spokeswoman Liz Throssell says over the past few weeks, an increasing number of human rights defenders have been intimidated and threatened. She says one activist received death threats after issuing an anti-corruption press statement. When he went to the police, she says the police ignored his complaint and did not provide him with any protection. And she says more women are being victimized.
We're also concerned about an emerging pattern of threats and violence against women members of parliament and electoral candidates. For example, one female MP's car was torched in Mangochi in the south of the country in August.
Throssell says the current pattern of pre-electoral violence is reminiscent of similar attacks that occurred in 2011, a year marked with heightened attacks against civil society. She warns people's rights to freedom of expression, peaceful assembly, and association are at risk. The UN Human Rights Office is urging government authorities to investigate the threats and attacks against human rights defenders and to ensure they can carry out their crucial work in a safe and protected environment. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Zimbabwe's health minister late Thursday asked Zimbabweans to up their hygienic game in light of five deaths, which the government suspects are a result of cholera. Columbus Mavunga reports from Harare.
David Parirenyatwa, Zimbabwe's health minister, confirmed to reporters late Thursday while visiting a temporary cholera treatment camp in Harare that about 40 people were being treated for cholera while five people had died after showing signs of the waterborne disease, namely diarrhea and vomiting.
So to us here, this is typically an outbreak of cholera, which we must contain as a country. So it's usually a problem of water, contaminated water. So far, those that we have here are getting, most of them are getting much, much better. As usual, prevention is key. Otherwise, we will have an outbreak throughout the country. So nobody will be asked to pay for that. We will do it. We will be treated here free because this is an emergency.
In 2008-2009, the waterborne disease claimed about 5,000 lives and only stopped after international aid organizations like USAID chipped in with medical drugs and water-treating chemicals. Itairu Sike, the head of the Community Working Group on Health, a local health watchdog, says Zimbabwe's government did not learn much from that 2008-2009 cholera outbreak.
Our worry is the general lack of political will, you know, to address, you know, the perennial water challenges, to address the issue of refuse collection, you know, to address the issue of sanitation. As long as we don't address those, cholera will always be around. Cholera is a primitive disease, long forgotten, you know, in other parts of the world. And it would be very sad, you know, when Harare talks of trying to grapple with such forgotten diseases. I think it's a shame, you know, for the country.
Zimbabwe's Health Minister Parirenyatwa said the issue of poor water supply, hygiene, and poor waste disposal in the densely populated areas in Harare and other parts of the country would be improved in light of the cholera outbreak. He said President Emmerson Mnangagwa's government did not want cholera-related death toll to increase. Columbus Mavunga for VOA's Daybreak Africa, Harare.
Five minutes past the hour, time now for Daybreak Africa Sports. Here is Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. A very good Friday morning to you, Samson.
Good Friday morning to you, James. We begin the sports with a look at match day 2 fixtures ahead of the 2019 CAF African Cup of Nations qualifiers taking place this weekend across various venues on the continent. Ghana will be away to Kenya on Saturday in what is the Black Stars' first visit to the East African country in 13 years. But their coach Kwesi Appiah knows their work is cut out for them when they meet the Harambee Stars in Nairobi.
This particular game, they invited a lot of new foreign players, and for that reason you can't depend on what you forge, because they could change the players tactically, they could change your style of play. So the most important thing is prepare very well, you know, so that whichever way tactically, you know, we'll be able to face them.
Harambee Stars head coach Sebastian Megne has left captain and Tottenham Hotspur midfielder Victor Wanyama, McDonald Mariga and Boniface Oluoch out of the Harambee Stars squad.
What is interesting is to have this morning 24 players and to have your full team, because I don't want to speak about the player who are absent.
At the southern tip of the continent, South Africa's Bafana Bafana will need to break their hoodoo against the lowly ranked opposition when they take on Libya on Saturday at the Moses Mabhida Stadium in Durban. Coach Stuart Baxter remains confident despite losing his key players to injuries.
If we can continue to take points, it may be done and dusted before the end of the group. And so we do want that. We don't want it to go all the way to the wire.
Elsewhere, the Cranes of Uganda will host the Taifa Stars of Tanzania in a Group L match in Kampala. Meanwhile, Ugandan coach Sebastian Desabre has called up a 24-man squad to do the job for him.
The most important is the position in the group, because we have two qualify, and it's important to be first or second. The most important is to go to the next AFCON in Cameroon.
In other matches, Mozambique are bidding to end a 4-year tournament absence at AFCON following their hard-fought victory over neighbours Zambia away from home. They will face Group K joint leaders Guinea-Bissau. Staying with football, the outgoing president of the Liberia Football Association, Musa Biliti, has officially transferred authority to president-elect Mustafa Raji. Daybreak Africa reporter Moses Gazau in Monrovia asked Mr. Biliti to reflect on his term at the helm of Liberia's highest football body.
I hope that I'm leaving an FA that is responsive, that is properly positioned to look into the future and play a much bigger role than it was when we came into office.
What was your most disappointing moment being president of the Liberian FA?
It's always the lack of money syndrome that is always humbugging football in Liberia. I hope that the next president will not have to face that.
You came with a commercialization plan. Did you succeed in any way?
We did. Up to today, clubs don't pay money. Up to today, to a larger extent, we've done very well to keep the organization going on our own ideas and merit. But without government intervention, without government participation, football cannot go the way it should go.
And that's it for Daybreak Africa Sports. I am Samson O'Malley in Abuja, Nigeria. It's back to you, James, in Washington.
Thank you, Samson. Have a good weekend. We look forward to your report again on Monday morning. And that is it for this Friday, September 4th edition. September 7th edition of Daybreak Africa. We thank you for spending this week with us. I'm James Barton in Washington, wishing you in Africa a very good weekend.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA. Next up, a conversation with Jeff Pigues, author of the new book, Kompromat, How Russia Undermined American Democracy. Pigues says despite recent indictments of Russian persons and entities, Vladimir Putin's operatives continue to try to sabotage U.S. democracy as we head into midterm elections. That's Press Conference USA this Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
Hello, this is Shaka Sali, host of Straight Talk Africa.
On the next Straight Talk Africa, a discussion with Ugandan pop star Bobby Wine on his arrest, detention and release, and why he came to the U.S. to seek medical attention. Ugandan politics in the spotlight on the next Straight Talk Africa.
Tune in Wednesdays at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.